they were not with the homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, everyone. Well, it was some trip I made to California. I gave lectures on Abhidhamma. No, I take you to California. I was there. And everybody was so impressed by me. No, you have to speak the truth. You were just staying in the room. I left you behind. No, I was there. Okay, where did you stay in California? I stayed at the Tathagata Meditation Center. But the Tathagata Meditation Center is in San Jose. Where was the conference?
Conference was in... where was the conference?
Okay, you better go back to sleep, okay? Okay, so where were we last time? Last time was March 5th. We are in the Kosambiya Sutta. This is Sutta number 48. And last time we dealt with the first part of the sutta, which discusses what are called the six principles of harmony and respect. And then the last of the six principles of harmony and respect is harmony in views. So the text says, I'm on page 421 in the sutta, the monk dwells both in public and in private, possessing in common with his companions in the holy life that view that is noble and emancipating and leads one who practices in accordance with it to the complete destruction of suffering. So in other words, the harmony of the Buddhist Sangha depends upon maintaining what is called the special, or this would be the world-transcending right view, the right view that leads out from the round of birth and death, samsara, and brings the attainment of nibbana, or complete liberation, which is here called the complete destruction of suffering. So in the Noble Eightfold Path, we actually have the first factor is right view, and the Buddha established right view as the primary or preliminary factor in personal practice, because it's right view that guides the development of all the other seven factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. So we can say that right view is, I call it sometimes the eye of the path, that is the factor that sees the way. And then the other seven factors are like the legs of the path, or the legs that walk on the path, the legs that of actual practice that enable one to travel along the path. And so the Buddha laid special emphasis on this right view by putting it at the very beginning of the path. And then we could say that the cultivation of the path or the development of the path culminates in the true emancipating right view, which is the right view of panya, or wisdom. The right view which sees first into the three characteristics of impermanence, suffering, non-self. The right view which sees dependent origination. And then especially the right view that sees, directly sees, experientially sees the Four Noble Truths. And it's when one reaches that experiential right view of the Four Noble Truths that one steps onto the truly liberating path, the world-transcending path, that will eventually culminate in the destruction of suffering. And so for the Buddhist community to flourish in harmony, here the Buddha emphasizes that it's important for the, well, he mentions the monks, but I would say everybody in the Buddhist community to dwell in harmony with respect to that liberating, that noble and liberating right view. And so then the Buddha concludes this section and says, this too is a principle of cordiality, or a principle of harmony, that creates love and respect and leads to cohesion, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. Okay, so those are the six principles of cordiality, or the six principles of harmony and respect. Okay, now the Buddha is going to lay again special emphasis on the sixth principle of harmony. And starting in paragraph 7, he says, of these six principles of cordiality, the chief, the most cohesive, the most unifying is this view that is noble and emancipating, and which leads the one who practices in accordance with it to the complete destruction of suffering. Then he gives a simile, just as the chief, the most cohesive, the most unifying part of a pinnacled house is the pinnacle itself, so too of these six principles of harmony, of cordiality, the chief is the view that is noble and emancipating. So we have, well, this building isn't constructed in that way. Or maybe we could say, maybe we could even take this building. If you look up at the hall, the roof of the hall, this is the ceiling of this hall, you see that there are many beams that hold the building in place. And there's one beam that runs from one side of the hall to the other. Maybe that is analogous to the pinnacle of the roof of the peaked house. Then all of the other beams of this building are connected to that central beam, the very top, and it's that central beam that holds all of the others in place. And so in a house with the pinnacle roof, it's the pinnacle that holds all of the other beams together. And so amongst these six principles of cordiality, it is the right view, the liberating view, that holds the others together. If you have the others without the liberating view, then you might have a harmonious community, but it's not a harmonious community founded around the aspiration or the ideal of emancipation, spiritual emancipation. But when you put this harmony based on right view, the liberating view in place, then the other five principles of harmony and respect come together, and they promote harmony and respect in their own right, And they also draw all of the participants in the community together around this aspiration or ideal of emancipation. And when the Buddha speaks about the right view that's noble and emancipating, what he has in mind particularly is the right view that is achieved at the first level by the stream enterer, the Sotapanna, one who has entered the stream of the Dhamma and is bound to reach final emancipation in a maximum of 7 lives, but perhaps even in that same life. And so the entire practice of the Buddha Dhamma, you could say, initially culminates in this world-transcending right view. And so the task for the practitioner, still in the stage of the ordinary person or the worldling, is to arrive at the right view of wisdom, the right view of panya, of insight wisdom. And then when one acquires that right view of insight wisdom, then one can use that right view in order to chop away at all of the remaining bonds and fetters of the mind until the mind becomes completely unbound and unfettered, liberated. Of course, to achieve that right view, one has to undertake the practice. It's not enough just to read books, to have discussions, to study, but it's through the practice of the other factors of the Eightfold Path that the world-transcending right view will arise. But at the initial stage, the emphasis is on getting that right understanding, that penetrative understanding. And so the Buddha usually doesn't admonish his disciples to go into the deep samadhis, you know, the formless jhanas and so on, in the earlier stages of training, but rather to get the penetrative right view. Then with that penetrative right view, one can cultivate and mature all the other factors of the path, until they're all working together in harmony to liberate the mind from the deepest kilesas or defilements. And so now the Buddha is going to go on to explain this right view in terms of a disciple at this first stage of realization, the stage of the Sotapanna, or the stream enterer. So now we're in paragraph 8. He raises the question, how does this view that is noble and emancipating lead the one who practices in accordance with it to the complete destruction of suffering? Okay, then he gives a case of here the monk gone to the forest or to the root of a tree or to an empty hut, considers thus, is there any obsession unabandoned in myself that might so obsess or so overwhelm my mind that I cannot know or see things as they actually are? Okay, now a disciple who is a stream enterer is still not free from the 5 hindrances, or at least he's not completely free from 4 of them. What are the 5 hindrances? Who remembers them?
Sloth
and torpor. Wait, who's speaking?
Sloth and torpor.
We have to get the right order.
Sexual desire.
Okay.
You will.
Okay.
Sloth.
Okay.
Restlessness and worries.
Okay.
And
Okay. I said this Santapanna is free from one of the five hindrances. Which one is he free of?
Doubt.
Free of doubt, right. But his mind, or the other hindrances, can still arise in the mind. But the point that's going to be brought out is that even though the hindrances might arise, they don't overwhelm the mind to such an extent that they can completely obscure or block out his right understanding. Okay, so he asked, is there any unabandonment in myself that might so obsess my mind that I cannot know or see things as they actually are? Okay, then the Buddha illustrates what kind of obsessions he's referring to. So he's referring to obsession by sensual lust, obsession by ill will, obsession by sloth and torpor, obsession by restlessness and remorse, obsession by doubt. Those are the usual five hindrances. Then he adds also two other obsessions. One is called obsession about the world, that is speculation about the world, probably whether the world is eternal, non-eternal, infinite or finite, created or uncreated, and so on. We have a speculation about this world, speculation about the other world. And then the seventh is that the monk gets involved in quarrels and disputes. That's a kind of obsession. Why does the Buddha mention, especially here, getting involved in quarrels and disputes?
Because it's about harmony. The sutta is talking about harmony.
Yeah, but something a little more specific. Well, that's the background story, but what happened? What happened as a result of that? Yeah, the background story to the sutta is that the monks have become divided into, have become involved in a conflict over a very minor point of bathroom etiquette. And they were quarreling and disputing, and they wouldn't allow themselves to be reconciled with one another. And so the Buddha wants to underscore the need for harmony, so he refers here to becoming deep in disputes, stabbing others with verbal daggers. Okay, so the Buddha is now taking the case of the monk who is presumably a stream enterer, so he says that this monk understands thus, there is no obsession unabandoned in myself that might so obsess my mind that I cannot know and see things as they actually are. My mind is well disposed for awakening to the truths, that is, for the Four Noble Truths. Okay, so the way I understand it, this monk hasn't, because he's presumably not yet an arhat, he's not completely eliminated all of the five hindrances. And four of them can still arise in him. The hindrance of sensual desire, the hindrance of ill will, the hindrance of sloth and torpor and restlessness and remorse. But he wouldn't have the hindrance of doubt, and his mind would not get obsessed by speculation about the world. And I don't know whether a stream enterer can get involved in disputes, but I don't think he would remain, especially if the Buddha said, draw back from these disputes, I don't think he would persist in them. But even though the stream enters his mind when he's not being mindful or diligent, can be overrun, or let's say, even though some of these hindrances can arise, they don't completely obsess his mind so that he loses that ability to know and see things as they really are. This is because he's acquired that right view, and he can use that right view, he can cultivate that right view so that his wisdom will grow stronger and stronger until it brings the full awakening which marks the attainment of arhatship. Okay, then paragraph 9. The noble disciple considers thus, when I pursue, develop, and cultivate this view, do I personally obtain serenity? Do I personally obtain, here word is translated as quenching, which might not be so clear. The word that's translated serenity is samatha. And the word that's translated as quenching is nibbuddhi, which in Sanskrit is written. So it seems to have some relation to the word nibbana, even though the two words actually come from different roots. The word nibbana comes from the root va, which means to blow. And so nirvana, or Pali nibbana, is the going out or blowing out of a flame, a fire. Whereas the word nibbuddhi, or Sanskrit nivritti, comes from the root vr, which means to become, something like to become active, or to become activated. And then nibbuddhi is like deactivation. And then it comes to signify a state of peace, inner quiescence. And because nirvritti and nirvana, though they are from different roots, but they look similar, so what happens in the Buddhist literature is that the two words come almost so close together that they almost touch each other. So nibbuddhi comes to be used almost as a synonym for nibbana. Okay, so what's interesting about this passage is that the disciple, by pursuing, developing, and cultivating this view, he obtains serenity, or obtains this inner peacefulness, this quiescence or quenching. And this, it seems to me, to indicate that this is a kind of world-transcending right view or a world-transcending wisdom that can be used to induce a state of inner samadhi. This seems to be a different kind of samadhi from the samadhi, which is developed as a preliminary stage to developing wisdom. In the usual meaning of samadhi, one chooses an object on which to focus the mind, like in and out breathing, or a kasina, the colored disc, or the loving kindness, and one just goes on focusing on that object over and over. And as one goes on focusing, over time, through repeated practice, the mind becomes collected, drawn in, absorbed in that object. And through that sustained attention to the object, one enters deeper concentration, which eventually becomes samadhi. Then one uses the mind of samadhi, the concentrated mind, to investigate the nature of body and mind, the sankharas or conditioned factors of body and mind. And on that basis, panya or wisdom arises. And then one develops that wisdom further until one makes the breakthrough to realization. So that is the normal procedure, the sequence of based on sila or moral conduct. One develops samadhi. On the basis of samadhi, one develops wisdom. But now, once the disciple achieves that world-transcending wisdom, or that emancipating right view, he could draw in within himself and contemplate things as they really are, and in this way collect the mind in a way that harmonizes samadhi and wisdom. So wisdom becomes the forerunner, which brings the mind to a state of inner collectedness, inner quiescence. And in that inner quiescence, there's also the power of panya operating. And so the Buddha says that when he raises this question, he understands that when I pursue, develop, and cultivate this view, that is, this liberating right view, I personally obtain serenity. I personally obtain quenching or quiescence. So this is the second knowledge attained by him that is noble, super mundane, it's world transcending, and it's not shared by ordinary people. In other words, this is not a kind of knowledge which is held in common by people who are called puttujanas, simple worldlings or ordinary people, but this is the knowledge of somebody who is a noble disciple, one who is already irreversibly on the path to final liberation. Maybe I'll ask at this point if there's any question.
I don't mean this necessarily in a personal way, but am I an ordinary person?
Of course, I can't say for sure, but
is everybody here an ordinary person, or you are not?
Excuse me?
I said, you are not an ordinary person.
Well, I have to confess I am.
What is everybody else here? Because you refer to ordinary persons in a number of paragraphs.
But you said ordinary is being used here in a specific, somewhat technical sense. It doesn't mean that we're just dull, flat, how else, boring, common, stupid members of the unenlightened masses. That's not quite derogatory in that sense. But a distinction is made in the Buddhist texts between those who are Aryans, those who are noble ones, who have reached some stage of realization of the truth of the Dhamma through a direct penetrative experience into the ultimate truth, and then the great masses of people who, even though they might be well-developed spiritually, culturally, intellectually, but if they don't have that penetrative, direct experiential realization, they're still ordinary people. Yeah.
And just one more question. This is already a discussion of the Eightfold Noble Path, because it's talking about a release from suffering.
Yeah. 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 But here, what's meant by the right view that's being discussed here is not just the preliminary right view of the Noble Eightfold Path, but this is the right view that emerges when the eight path factors have been cultivated to the point where that world-transcending wisdom has arisen. And then it becomes a direct experiential right view of the Four Noble Truths. Any other question on what's been covered so far?
I think when you say when a stream enterer is obsessed with the other four hindrances, he's not completely obsessed with it because of his right view.
Yeah, yeah.
Does that mean a stream?
Maybe to say that he's obsessed with it wouldn't be quite correct. I would say that they can arise in him, but they don't obsess him because he has the ability to put them away.
Does that mean a stream enterer never lost his right view, even at a moment, not at a single moment?
I don't think it means that the stream enterer is always every moment reflecting on right view or seeing things with right view. If he's taking a walk, he might just be involved with his walking. If having a discussion, involved in the discussion, if eating a meal, could be involved with whether the food is salty enough or spicy enough for his taste. So it's not that all the time the right view is actively present, but the right view is sort of always, always available at his command, so that if he wants to bring it up, he just has to make that determination and the right view will arise. That's the way I understand it.
So in terms of right view, his condition is exactly the same as that of an arahant?
I wouldn't say exactly the same. It seems to me that, let us say that there are four curtains. It's like the sun shining, and there are four curtains between our eyes and the sun. Okay, this is for an ordinary person. There are four curtains. Maybe even the first curtain is of different degrees of thickness. So for most people, that first curtain is more like a wall with three curtains behind it. But in the case of the stream enterer, the first curtain has been pulled away. So there are three curtains. So he can see the sun, but not so brightly yet. The case of a once returner, he's pulled away the second curtain. The non-returner has pulled away the third curtain, so there's only one curtain between the non-returner and the sun. And then the arhat has pulled away the fourth curtain, and so the arhat could see the sun directly. So I say that even though what they're seeing is the same, the content of the right view is the same, but the strength, the clarity would be successively, let's say the right view would be successively stronger and clearer at each higher stage.
Second question.
Yeah.
Do you distinguish samatha from samadhi? Could I say samatha is what is related with insight, and samadhi is just the absorption?
I think it's more the... Normally it's more the opposite way. Well, let us say that normally samatha means the kind... the state of calmness or tranquility which... Let's put it this way. Okay, let us say that samadhi has a broader range than samatha, the way the word samatha is normally used. Normally, samatha is the type of calmness or tranquility which is achieved through focusing the mind on a single object. So it's the kind of tranquility that is achieved in the preliminary stages to the jhanas and in the jhanas themselves. So that is a samadhi which is gained through collecting the mind on a single object. Now usually samadhi is used very much as a synonym for samatha. But sometimes the texts speak about a kind of samadhi which seems to be aroused on the basis of insight. So somebody who is engaged in very intense insight practice, the mind becomes collected and concentrated, but it's not collected and concentrated on a single unchanging object as it is in samatha. But one is observing the process of experience which is always changing, always arising and passing away. So normally that is not spoken of as a samatha samadhi, but sometimes the texts, especially the commentaries, use the expression vipassana samadhi. And even in the suttas there are sometimes texts which speak about somebody having a concentrated mind or being in a state of concentration where it's clear from the context that it's a focus based on insight rather than samatha, tranquility. But normally when we speak of like sila, samadhi, panya, normally that samadhi is the samadhi of samatha. Okay, should we, any questions or should we go on? Okay, then I'll go on to the next. Okay, so that is the second special knowledge. Okay, the third, here the noble disciple reflects thus, is there any other recluse or Brahman, then the text uses the expression, outside here? Ito bahidat. And that usually always means outside the Buddha's teaching. So is there any other recluse, ascetic or Brahman outside the fold of the Buddha's teaching that possesses a view such as I possess? In other words, is there any other ascetic or Brahman outside here who possesses this view of dependent origination, the three characteristics, and especially the view of the Four Noble Truths? And he understands thus, there is no other ascetic or Brahman outside here, outside the range of the Buddha's teaching, who possesses a view such as I possess. So that is the third knowledge attained by him that's noble, supermundane, world-transcending, not shared by ordinary people. Okay, so this view of the Four Noble Truths, that's said to be the special discovery of the Buddha. And so it's taught by the Buddha. And even though we find maybe in some spiritual teaching some recognition of the relationship between craving and suffering, but that relationship is not articulated so clearly and laid out in such a systematic framework as in the Buddha's teaching. And especially to arrive at the world-transcending right view, this requires the prior cultivation of contemplation of dependent origination, paticca-samuppada, and the prior contemplation of the three characteristics, impermanence, suffering, non-self, the contemplation of the characteristics of the five aggregates. And so all of these modes of contemplation are quite special to the Buddha's teaching. And so it's only through these contemplations that one can arrive at the right view of that special world-transcending view of the Four Noble Truths. Okay, so then this is the third kind of knowledge possessed by this, attained by this disciple, which is noble, super mundane, not shared by ordinary people. Okay, now the Buddha is going to take up what is called the character. The word here is dhammata, or we could even say the nature of a person who possesses this right view. So the word dhammata is based, of course, on the word dhamma. So dhamma, often the word dhamma often means simply the Buddha's teaching, but originally it means something like the nature of a thing. And so the nature of a person, the nature of things in general, becomes dhammata. And the nature of a person also is dhammata, the nature of that person. So you can call this the character of the person, in this case, the one who possesses this right view. Okay, so then the Buddha is going to explain this specifically in relation to a monastic person. So he says, this is the character of a person who possesses right view. Although he may commit some kind of offense for which a means of rehabilitation has been laid down, still he at once confesses, reveals, and discloses it to the teacher, that is to the Buddha, or to his wise companions in the holy life. And having done so, he enters upon restraint for the future. So this is dealing with the precepts of the monastic life, which fall into two very broad categories. One is a group of precepts for which there is no rehabilitation. These are the four grave offenses, and if one commits any of these, the consequence is that one loses one's status as a member of the monastic sangha. For the monks, the four, we call these in Pali parachika offenses, which means literally defeating offenses. We can call them expulsion offenses. If one commits one of these, then one has to leave one's membership in the monastic sangha. And the four defeating or expulsion offenses, one is engaging in sexual intercourse. Second is stealing something of such value that one would be subject to legal punishment under the law. Third will be killing another human being or inducing the killing of another human being. And the fourth is making false claims to higher spiritual realization. Deliberately making false claims. Okay, so then all of the other offenses are called offenses from which one can be rehabilitated. And the main means of rehabilitation is through confession to another, a fellow monk, or in the case of a nun, fellow nun. Okay, and then in addition to committing the offense itself, sort of to add to the gravity of the offense is concealing it. So if one conceals it, it means one is trying to protect, in a sense, protect oneself from admitting one's faults or shortcomings. But here the Buddha says that the character of a person with right view is such that even though sometimes through negligence or maybe even through strong temptation, he might commit some kind of offense of a kind for which there's rehabilitation, but he doesn't try to conceal it or to cover it up, but he will confess it, reveal it, and disclose it to either to the Buddha, but more usually to fellow monks. And then after that, then he will enter upon restraint for the future. And then the text illustrates this with the simile of a young infant who puts his foot or hand on a hot coal and then at once pulls the hand back, hand or foot back. Okay, so if the disciple sees that he has that kind of character, then he understands, I possess the character of a person who possesses right view. Okay, so this is the fourth knowledge. Now we go on to the fifth knowledge, which also pertains to the character of a person with right view. And the text says, even though he may be active in various matters for his companions in the holy life or spiritual life, yet he has a keen regard for training in the higher virtue, for training in the higher mind, or in other words, training in samadhi, and training in the higher wisdom. So, some monks or monastics are able to devote themselves fully to the training. So they can go off into seclusion and devote themselves pretty much full time to meditation in order to develop samadhi and wisdom. But other monastics become involved in taking on responsibilities and duties, either for the Sangha or for the Buddhist community. For example, they might become skillful teachers or lecturers or giving discourses, teaching. Sometimes if he's a gifted preacher, he'll get many invitations from lay people to go to their towns and villages to give discourses. Or he might take on some responsibility in the Sangha, like arranging the food schedule for people who want to offer food to the temple, or take on responsibility for cleaning the premises, or maintaining the storerooms, or nowadays maybe editing a newsletter or bulletin. So various kinds of duties and responsibilities. But even though he becomes involved in these responsibilities, but he doesn't lose his dedication to the training. But whenever there is opportunity, he'll devote himself to the practice. Because even for a monastic person, it's very easy to get sucked in by duties and responsibilities, and then one thinks, ah, I became a monk to meditate, but I've heard this so many times, but I just have too much work to do, no time to meditate. Sometimes they even say, oh, when I was a lay person, I would get like 2 weeks vacation so I could go on retreat. But now, since I became a monk, just from 5 o'clock in the morning until 10 o'clock at night, I'm busy with duties. So no time to practice. Maybe next life I'll get a better opportunity. But the person with right view will always have this keen regard for the training, so that even though his time might be limited, but whenever there's some time during the day, he'll always set up certain periods for the practice in order to develop serenity and insight. Okay, and now we come to the, so far we've covered 5 of the knowledges that are said to be noble, supramundane, not shared by ordinary people. Now we come to the 6th and 7th deal with what is called the strength of this noble disciple, or the strength of the person who possesses right view. The strength is the power. If I remember, the Pali word is balata. And these two, well, first the word balata is based on the word bala, which means power or strength. So balata just turns it into an abstract noun. And these two types of knowledge, interestingly, are concerned with listening to the Dhamma, how one listens to the Dhamma when it's being explained. So here the noble disciple reflects, do I possess the strength of a person who possesses right view? And what is the strength of a person who possesses right view? That when the Dhamma and discipline proclaimed by the Tathagata is being taught, then he heeds it. That is, he listens to it very closely. He gives it attention. He engages it with all his mind, and he listens to the Dhamma with eager ears, as though he's trying to absorb everything he can with his ears. So it's not the case of just listening and letting the information come into one ear and out the other, but one pays very careful and close attention and tries to retain it. In the Buddha's day, especially, they didn't have writing was not widespread. I'm not even certain that it was used at all. Certainly it wasn't used for record spiritual teachings. And so to preserve the teaching as a guide for one's own understanding and practice, one has to pay very close attention to it. There's a sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya where the Buddha speaks about 3 ways in which people listen to Dhamma. Maybe you could use these three ways to consider where you fit. One way is like a bucket. They're all compared to a bucket. One way is like a bucket with big holes on the bottom. So if you pour water into the bucket with big holes on the bottom, what happens to the water? It leaks out. What is it?
Immediate.
Yeah, yeah. Perhaps it even said the bucket without a bottom. So then you just pour the water in and it just comes flowing right out. So that's the kind of person who goes to hear Dhamma talk. Then he comes back home and you ask him, what did you learn today when you heard the Dhamma talk? Then an embarrassed smile. It was a very interesting talk. I remember when I was in Sri Lanka, people would say that, oh, I read this book of yours. It was very interesting. Then I would ask them, what did you get out of it? It would be, Okay, so that's like listening to the, it's like filling up the bucket when the bucket has a hole on the bottom. The water just comes right through. The second kind is like filling up a bucket and the bucket has sort of little, almost indiscernible cracks on the bottom, you know, where the bottom is welded onto the bottom is the base, where the bottom is welded onto the cylinder part of the bucket. Sometimes there can be little cracks. And what happens to the water?
Slowly seeps out.
So, you know, when you look at it right after the water has been poured in, you think the bucket is full. But 10 minutes later, if you look, you see the bucket is half full. Half an hour later, the bucket is a quarter full. 40 minutes later, the bucket is empty. So that's like a person who listens to the Dhamma sort of half attentively. You know, they absorb some things. If you repeat the principles often enough, they'll remember, but other important things that are not stressed as much, they'll forget. And then after a few days, they forget everything. Then the third way of listening to the Dhamma is like the bucket, which is well constructed, solid, without leaks, without any cracks or holes. And so when you pour the water in, then the water will last, you know, for weeks and months. That is like the kind of listening that's the ideal way of listening. Listening with full attention and being attentive to what one hears. Okay, so this is the strength, the first strength of a person who possesses right view. That when the Dhamma and Vinaya are being spoken, then he pays really close attention and engages it fully with his mind and then retains a large amount of it. Okay, so the disciple reflecting on himself knows, I possess the strength of a person who possesses right view. So that is the sixth knowledge. Then the seventh knowledge, again the disciple asks himself, do I possess the strength of the person who possesses right view? And what is that strength? Here, when the Dhamma and discipline proclaimed by the Tathagata is being taught, he gains, here the text uses certain expression, Atta-veda, Dhamma-veda, Dhammupasanghitam, Pamojam. The two key words here, what is translated as inspiration in the meaning and inspiration in the Dhamma. The Pali words are Yeah, the key words or the key expressions are Atta-Veda and Dhamma-Veda. These two expressions are often paired in the texts. And it's difficult to know exactly what is meant by them. But the word Veda comes from the root Ved, which has two nuances. One nuance is that of to feel. So from Ved, we get the word Vedana, which means feeling. But the second nuance of Ved gives you the verb Vindati, to find, and gives us the noun Vija, which means knowledge, higher knowledge. And from the root Ved, we also get the word Veda, which becomes the name for the sacred scriptures of Brahmanism. Originally, I think they were considered the words of wisdom, and so they were called Veda. Perhaps even the word wisdom itself comes from the same root, Vid. I'm not sure about that. In German, Wissen is to know. Anybody speak German?
Yeah.
You do?
No.
Wissen is knowledge or wisdom? Wisdom also, or just knowledge?
Both, I think.
Yeah, so it seems that there's a etymological connection between Vidya, or Sanskrit Vidya, and German Wissen, and English Wisdom. Okay, so according to the commentary, the word Veda here is a kind of, you might call it, a joyous understanding. It's a certain state of mind that combines understanding, the act of knowing, with a feeling of joy. So, I'm not sure whether it was Venerable Nyanamoli or myself who thought of inspiration as a rendering for Veda. Because inspiration conveys more the sense of joy. Inspiration, upliftment, but also there's an insight here. And then that insight is directed to two things, Atta and Dhamma. The exact distinction between them, it's not very clear. The explanations in the commentary, not really so convincing. The way I understand it, inspiration in the Dhamma would be the inspiration that comes from the teaching itself, from the formulation of the teaching. Then Atta-Veda, the inspiration and the meaning, is the inspiration that comes when one understands the meaning and also gets some intuitive sense of the benefit that comes from the teaching. Of course, the word Atta also means good or benefit. So the word Atta has actually four meanings. Let's say three meanings. Goal, meaning, and benefit or good. And the way the word Atta is used in the text, it's sometimes difficult to separate out these meanings and say in this place Atta means meaning, in that place it means good or benefit, in that place it means the goal or purpose. But rather the three are just, often they're intertwined in a way that makes them inseparable. And so as the disciple is listening, he gets inspiration from the Dhamma, from the teaching itself, and inspiration from the meaning of the teaching, and from the sense of the benefit or good opened up by the teaching. and inspiration from the goal or purpose pointed to by the teaching. And so the strength of this disciple is in gaining that inspiration in the meaning, inspiration in the Dhamma, and this gladness or joy connected with the Dhamma. And when he knows that he possesses this, this is said to be the seventh knowledge attained by him, which is noble, supermundane, not shared by ordinary people. Okay, then the last paragraph of the sutta makes a very important statement. It says, it is a statement that confused me for some time. When a noble disciple is thus possessed of seven of these seven factors, that is, these seven kinds of knowledge, he has well sought the character for realization of the fruit of stream entry. When a noble disciple is thus possessed of these seven factors, he possesses the fruit of stream entry. To explain my confusion gets a little bit technical, but I'll try it. I was uncertain. You see, we have two sentences here, and it seems that the first sentence is saying that the noble disciple who possesses these seven factors has the qualifications needed to realize the fruit of stream entry, but he has not yet realized the fruit. Rather, he's sort of accumulated the required conditions, and he's now on the way, on the path to realize the fruit of stream entry, but he hasn't yet realized the fruit. But then the second sentence says that the noble disciple who possesses these seven factors possesses the fruit of stream entry, which means that he's already realized the fruit, not that he's on the way to realizing the fruit. So doesn't there seem to be something a little inconsistent or problematic there? Excuse me?
You don't seem contradictory.
Not contradictory, but...
Or mutually exclusive.
Excuse me?
Or mutually exclusive. They don't seem mutually exclusive ideas or contradictory.
Yeah, certainly not contradictory.
So why can't you...
Does anybody else have any idea? Neil? Yeah, take the microphone.
No, it kind of reads to be like the noble disciple is thus possessed of the seven factors, has well sought, so in other words, they've successfully pursued these qualities, and then the next sentence, which probably nowadays we would have made it all one sentence.
Yeah.
You know, and therefore is now a stream enterer. That's how I would refer.
Yeah, that's the way I understand it now. But for quite a long time, it used to seem to me, not contradictory, but the first sentence seemed to be saying, as I said, that he's not yet realized the fruit, but he's got a sort of assembled the prerequisites for realizing it. And the second indicated that he's already realized it. But now I see it that the way I see it now, the first sentence is referring to, it's sort of confirming that he has already assembled these qualifications and has realized the fruit. And then the second just confirms this. You will?
I have a question. So does it imply that the process of acquiring the seven knowledges is the content of the training of a person who's on the way to be a Sotapanna?
It's an interesting point, because some of them, I mean, at least a few of them one could see as qualities that one has to develop. But others seem to me to be things that one can't quite acquire, but just sort of come spontaneously as part of the package with the breakthrough.
I thought that this whole section, starting from paragraph 8, from section 8, is about a person who is a noble disciple. So the person has to have attained stream entry. Person's only way to stream entry is not a noble disciple yet.
Yeah, but you see, technically, there is what is called the person who is practicing for realization of the fruit of stream entry. And that person is considered a noble disciple, though not yet the stream enterer. That is a person who has entered upon the supramundane path, but not yet realized the fruit.
That solves a big Mahayana problem then.
Another question? Somebody has a question? Did you have something to contribute? I saw you.
Well, I was just asking if one has the qualification on the path, is it guaranteed that one's going to get the fruit?
Yeah, the question is, if one... Okay, you can put it... The microphone is coming to you.
I guess it was just a qualification if one has the qualifications...
If one has the qualifications,
whether the fruit is going to be guaranteed.
Yeah, but it seems that the way I understand this passage now, this is speaking about a person who already has the fruit. Do you have anything to add? Any further questions? Okay, then we'll stop for now and we'll take the break. And then we'll come back here, maybe about 10 after 12, and any points that you want to discuss. And we can discuss more leisurely. Okay, we end with sharing the merits. And then next week we have the class, and next week we'll take very interesting, sometimes a little puzzling sutta. Puzzling, but stimulating sutta. This is sutta number 49, called Brahma Nimantanika Sutta, where the Buddha goes to the Brahma world and he has a discourse, it's a grand discourse with Brahma, one of the leading deities, and with Mara, the evil one. So it's a very dramatic, world-shaking discourse. Okay, so we... And that will be next week, April 2nd. Remember, 9:30, we have the meditation. And it's good for those people who want to join the meditation, try to get here at... 9:30 sharp, so we don't have the doors opening and closing between 9:30 and 10 as people come in late. Okay, so let us share the merits. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahidika punyantang anumoditva Chiran rakantu sasanam akasata chabumata deva naga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chiran rakantu desanam akasata chabumata deva naga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chiran rakantu mam param. Etavata cham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata cham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata cham hehi sampadam punya sampadam Sabbe sadhanu modantu Sabba sampati siddhya Bhavagupadaya vichihetato Etantare satakayu papanna Rupiya rupicha sanya saninam Dukha pamuchantu Pusantu nivutin with 3 bows for the Buddha. See, go to California for 3 weeks and I forget my routine of taking the chai. Okay, doesn't matter. 1, 2, 3.